Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where every other week, two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I'm Commander Duncan of the Border Force. That's right, there's an actual character this time. It's so rare to find a Duncan in a fantasy book. Weirdly, I wouldn't think it'd be this rare.
One day, Duncan, we're going to go back to the book that got you named, and we'll read the novelization of Macbeth, and then you can make jokes about it galore.
That would be amazing. Macbeth the King.
Macbeth the King, that's right.
That's named after it.
I happen to remember that because I was recently re-going back through an old episode of ours for Sisters of Steel and Shadow, and for a very specific reason. But let's not get distracted straight away because we are reviewing Bonesmith by Nikki
Palpretto.
Thank you, Duncan. This was your recommendation.
It is. I'm very excited to talk about this book. This is actually a relatively blind read for me. This is a Christmas present from my little sister. She got it for me. I had many books I listed, and I think there was a level of nervousness. She went, "I've gone off piece. I bought you something you didn't ask for, but I'm confident this should be up your alley when it comes to fantasy literature."
Interesting. And a strong recommendation, because your sister hasn't let us down before.
She certainly has not. Her fantasy knowledge, I think, probably exceeds mine at this point. Maybe we have our own different niches. I don't think she's coming near me when it comes to sword and sorcery pulp, but she's read so many books. So yeah, when she makes a recommendation, I do take it very seriously. So I am very excited to share our thoughts on Bonesmith. But before we get into that, Geordie, have you been reading, watching, experiencing any other fantasy you want to share with us?
Fantasy? Not exactly, but there's a reason why I was checking out our episode on Sisters of Steel and Shadow. Sword and Shadow?
But it's Sword and Shadow.
Sword and Shadow, okay. 2 years later, we still haven't gotten this one. The reason why I was revisiting it is that I have been rereading Bernard Cornwell's Warlord trilogy. I have read The Winter King and the follow-up Enemy of God.
Is this off the fact that it's got a TV adaptation recently?
I don't think that was recently, Duncan. I think that was like 2 years ago.
Oh, fair enough. Still on my to-watch list. I've only just got around to the Fallout TV show. I was like, oh my god, this is amazing. Someone should have told me. Sorry, go on.
It has nothing to do with the TV show. I have not seen it. The moment I saw the wigs in the trailer, I was like, not for me. No, I was, why did I start reading it again? I think you mentioned Bernard Cornwell last week and it just set me off. Had an amazing time. Those are fantastic books. For those who are not in the know, they are stories of King Arthur, but told from a very, obviously not historically accurate, because King Arthur did not exist. However, they are told from an emphasis on trying to represent the particular period of time where he should have existed. So the 400s, 450s, 60s, 80s, and trying to really root it in that time period.
Grounded, isn't it? Like, it's about making these very real people and cutting out all of the fantastical elements.
Yeah, all of the fantastical elements are sleight of hand. They're about tradition, they're about trickery, they're about the power of belief, but there's a logical explanation for pretty much all of Merlin's tricks.
And you liked it?
I really did. I really liked it. Not only had I forgotten how good they are, I'm pretty sure I just appreciate them more now.
It's certainly something I want to go back and revisit. As a child, I was a massive fan of Bernard Cornwell, reading both his Saxon and his Sharp stories. Mm. And I think The Winter King, because it's a neat trilogy, and obviously those other two series are massive, I think it's a much more smooth introduction to his work.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. And it's the ones that Bernard Cornwell says he's basically the most proud of. He thinks that's his best stuff. And I tend to agree with him. I mean, not that I've read his Sharp novels, so. But yeah, that's what I've been doing. I've been rereading those. I've caught up with, I listened to a previous episode on Sisters of Sword and Shadow. And it holds up. Although, my critique was great. And I think we are actually more prudent and delicate than I even remember us being, but I did realize that there is a solid, 5 minutes of radio silence at the end of that episode where I made an editing mistake, and I do not have the original file, so I can't fix it.
Ooh. Well, at least it was at the end. People can turn it off at that point.
But Duncan,
I forgive you,
in the meantime, have you been up to anything?
Yes, yes I have, and it's a continuation of what I've talked about several times this year. Geordie, I have like a 3-month subscription to Kindle Unlimited for like £3. Excellent Christmas deal. And on Kindle Unlimited, they have basically all of Dynamite's comics. And Dynamite published Red Sonja. Mm-hmm. Sword and Sorcery. Absolutely love the character. I'm sure she will appear on this podcast in a more formal fashion this year. Like, that is one of my kind of year goals. And I read yet another series. This is Red Sonja Mother, written by Mirka Andolfo. And it was very different to some of the other stories I've read so far. Red Sonja, for those who don't know, is a very classical sword and sorcery heroine character set in the same universe as Conan the Barbarian. And she gets amazing spins on her. Every time a new production guy, a new writing team comes in, they kind of do like a soft reboot. The most recent one, this Mother, title kind of gives it away a little bit, goes down a very lone wolf and cub story angle, which is not 100% new for the character.
Sure, so we're talking about Logan, we're talking about The Mandalorian, that sort of thing. A tough badass looks after a little kid.
Exactly, and it's one of those ones, and I think we've had this a few times on the podcast, where you look at something and you go, right, this is, I think it was in Green Rider I first said this, and I thought, this might come up later. When something's like a 10 out of 10, 7 out of 10, when something's like, this is really good for what you're going for, but I just feel like what you're going for maybe is just not the most exciting idea at this point.
Does Red Sonja not lend herself to a lone wolf and cub story? Is that what you're saying?
It's not what I'm saying. Red Sonja lends herself quite well because she is or can has been or can be portrayed as a very much a solitary soldier of fortune. I think that works. I think what it's kind of disappointing here, particularly compared to the last Red Sonja series I read, which took a very high political angle, multiple factions, the moral decision-making when you're looking after loads of soldiers, coming to terms with your own limits of your abilities, even though you're the best swordsman in the world. Having Red Sonja meet a kid and, you know, bond with the child, look after the child, have a bit of a separation, and you get to the end, and the ending of this arc is everything that you think it's going to be. It's The Last of Us. It's Empire of the Vampire. It's a group of cultists being like, if we sacrifice the child, we may save the world. And Red Sonja being like, no, I care for her too much. I will make the personally righteous choice, even though it may lead to greater sacrifice.
Right.
And I was just like, there's nothing wrong. If this was the first of this story I'd ever read, I would probably call it great. Mm. But I just don't think you're innovating at all in a lone wolf and cub story, even if your execution I think is really well done.
Sure, so despite the execution, the lack of ambition, the way it plays it safe really detracts from the whole.
Exactly.
Foreshadowing is a literary device in which...
Well, I've been trying to say in a rambling fashion, thank you very much, mate.
So do you recommend to fans of Red Sonja, do you recommend to non-fans of Red Sonja? I recommend the Warlord Trilogy to pretty much anyone who can... Yeah, anyone who enjoys historical fiction that has a sort of war focus to it.
I would recommend this to existing fans of Red Sonja, but this certainly wouldn't be the entry point for the character. Talking of entry points, actually, just a little bit more Red Sonja. Geordie, exciting news. The Red Sonja movie.
Yeah.
The new one. It was finished filming in 2023. And they've been looking for someone to distribute it for 2 years. Not a good sign. But it finally has a distributor just for the UK and Europe.
Wow.
So it's coming to cinemas near us.
Well, I'll definitely go see it, man. just to commemorate it, if anything else. So it's not releasing in the US?
At the moment, it will not have a theatrical release in the US. Who knows what will happen in the end? I imagine once it's out in theatres in the UK, that will start the clock ticking till it has to be available, via streaming or DVD if you live in the past.
I mean, yeah, it's not... So, nothing comes out to then just vanish. That's just not how it works anymore.
So I guess if they don't get a distributor in time, and they have confirmed it will come to the UK this year, then it will probably hit the US via streaming then and just miss a theatrical release. I can't imagine the UK release is going to be that massive either, but these are bad signs, but to be honest, I like the director. The director did the Solomon Kane movie.
There's a Solomon Kane movie?
And I enjoyed that movie. It's great. It came in 2009.
Wow. Have they made anything more recently than that?
Nothing that I can remember that I thought was good.
Okay, cool. Duncan, you're really selling this one to me.
Listen, set your expectations low, and I think you might be surprised.
Oh, Duncan, that's really almost word for word a line in this book.
That's right. Let's get onto that. Bonesmith.
Nice, very deliberate segue.
The first in a duology. This is not the first thing Nikki Palpretto has written. She's done several other works. I think she has an existing trilogy called like The Crown of a Feather. Maybe I've got that wrong. Maybe that's what the first book trilogy is called.
Riders.
She's also, when I was doing a bit of Googling, wrote a book that I was like, that sounds amazing. It's called, oh gosh, what is it? It's like The Last Chance School for Magical Delinquents. I was like, well, your title alone has sold me.
Yeah, I saw that.
But yes, Bonesmith. Part of a duology, the sequel is called Ghostsmith. This is a piece of YA fantasy where we follow the story of a Bonesmith, a character who has the magical ability to influence bones. And they live in a magical land where there are different clans. Bones.
Bones, Duncan.
Yes, bones. With bone armor and bone rings and bone swords.
And bone portcullises and bone decorations. Bones sewn into the structure of walls, which are
bone
harvested
dust?
From special anchor bones, which will be described to us many times rather than the story about how the different logistics of using bones in magic.
Bone!
Oh, no, it's the industrialization of bones, where these bonesmiths go out to do funeral rites, and from poor people, they collect payment. They just take certain bones.
Bone!
The point of the narrative is these people live in a world where the dead always rise as ghosts. Depending on who they were in life and the amount of their death, they may rise at different levels of strength of ghosts in a convenient tier system from 1 to 5. And this is a threat to the whole society. And what we get in this story, we follow a bonesmith called Wren, who is the sort of outcast from her noble house and sent to the border wall to live in shame. And the border wall separates the dominion, where they have a control on the ghosts, to the desolation, badlands, where a great breach has happened which has sent too many ghosts and they can't control it, so they built a wall. And some people have been trapped on the far side of the wall. They're sort of wildlings. No, the ironsmiths live on the far side of the wall. And when Wren is at the wall, a prince of the noble house comes visiting. He is kidnapped while on an excursion east of the wall, not north. East of the wall, and Wren teams up with an ironsmith who was betrayed by his own kind to go and rescue him. That is the narrative.
Yes,
plot.
It is. So before we go any further, Duncan, we said we would tell people that both of us are recording in separate but new locations. So we've done test recordings and they sound okay, but it's different when you record a whole new podcast. So we might have some teething problems for this episode, but hopefully everything will be sorted out by the next one.
Yes, thank you. Do bear with us. And do bear with me. I'm recovering from a bit of a cold, but I think I'm pretty much over it now.
Yeah, unfortunately, I always sound like this. So, Duncan, The Bonesmith. Yeah, it takes place in a world of very familiar ideas. You know, you have these different classes of magicians who have different powers. In this case, all wizards are called smiths. And you will have a power to control a different substance. So you've mentioned bonesmiths, but there's also ironsmiths who can control iron, goldsmiths, silversmiths, watersmiths, ghostsmiths, of course, the bad guys. And then, like, a bunch of stuff that, like, there used to be a bunch of different smiths who were very important, like tin smiths and copper smiths, but they are no longer required for an industrialized society, so they don't matter anymore.
It was woodsmiths, another one. I made that up.
Woodsmiths, I thought I'd mentioned them. Yes, woodsmiths are mentioned once as a sort of thing that's almost rumoured to exist, but like has been lost so long ago that they're scarcely even remembered.
So, Geordie, what are your kind of overall thoughts before we get into sort of specifics here?
Okay. My thoughts of
remember, what you say, I will feedback to my sister.
Yeah.
So
I wish you hadn't told me that this was her her gift to you, because I was correct when I said she has not read it, led us wrong. I should have said she's not led us wrong so far. Here's the deal, Duncan. This is not a bad book. It's written effectively.
I agree.
It's written excitingly, even. Maybe not as exciting as it could be. You know, I don't like the way that some of the fight scenes are written, for example. But it's enjoyable enough. The characters, the dynamic is okay. I really like Ren as your very typical spunky, determined female main character. It's a familiar archetype, but it's a welcome one. I like it. But it is familiar. It's very familiar. This whole book is extremely familiar. I could tell you everything about this book from maybe about 5 chapters in. Like, I made a bunch of predictions in my head, and pretty much all of them turned out to be true. Even one I made on, like, page 2.
Okay, I want to hear more about this one.
I mean, I can tell you, like, the moment a character is introduced to me, like, this was my father, but my uncle, who was a great war hero, was lost long ago, and I'd never been that close to my father. I'm like, yeah, because he's your uncle, and your dead uncle is actually your father. Moving on.
Okay, well, this is one where I actually didn't get that, but go on.
Spoiler heavy review. I don't feel like I can hold anything back in this one. I think this is an enjoyable enough book. If you like the sort of things like Throne of Glass, for example, yeah, you'll like this. It's better than Throne of Glass, but it's the same book. It's the same book that you've read 100 times. If you like reading the same book 100 times, whatever, you know? Duncan, what did you think?
Once again, I feel like I'm not necessarily in disagreement. I just have my own personal taste that's led a much more positive sensation with this book.
I totally understand. This is YA. Yeah.
This is the most YA fantasy, YA fantasy it's that I've ever read. It's just such the genre and yes. Such the tropes and such the expectations
straight
are there.
Straight down the middle.
This is a very well-worn, say, it's a very well-worn path. But like Jordy said, it wasn't poorly executed. I do have some criticisms that I want to get into.
Yeah, for sure.
But in general, even when the characters are doing things like, there's a bit of a romance in this book, and it plays out exactly how I was expecting it to play out, like beat for beat.
Yes.
But I still enjoyed the characters interacting. I was like, oh yeah, this is cute. I wasn't a love story for the ages. I wasn't like, oh, I really hope they end up together. But I was like, this is nice seeing you interact. Yeah, yeah. This is pleasant. And there were scenes of, like, tension. There's a scene where they have to, you know, they're sneaking into this place, they're eavesdropping on these villains, and, oh no, they're discovering this, you know, they're running out, and one person goes, go on without me, I shall make a stand, and
mm-hmm.
I was like, yeah, well, you're fine, mate, don't worry, because the page count is X, so I'm sure you'll get through, but it was still nice to see, and I also found that generally the world, it did only use the word bone in places, as Geordie referenced at the start.
It's incredible.
It still had a nice vibe to it.
I was reading passages to my girlfriend, and I was genuinely almost crying with laughter about how frequently the word bone is used.
Bone!
And not just because bone is a funny word. You cannot get past the repetition. It's truly unbelievable.
I definitely don't feel like it was needed to die in many places, but there was like a, you know, when we're in sort of east of the wall, so a border wall, come on, there were creepy moments, there were moments of tension. I never felt like obviously our characters were in danger, but I enjoyed the how they're gonna get out of this one dynamic, and in general I was rooting for the characters. I, you know, wanted to see them succeed, and no, I think that's really well mapped. Yeah, I liked it well enough. It came in, it did its job. It's something that I would definitely, I'm going straight to recommendations. If you are a fan of this genre and you want something more, here, this is another book in this genre that I think is quite good. You will probably enjoy it.
I am going to hold back what I say about recommendations. I know I already did say, yes, the exact same thing as you, Duncan. if you like this stuff, you'll like this stuff. But I have one more thing to say on that note, but I'd like to leave it for the end of the episode, which is where we normally do recommendations. Okay, so we've given an overall impression. Let's maneuver into, like, precise critiques. Let's start with the bad stuff, and then we'll go into the good stuff. How about that?
That sounds good to me, Geordie. And there's something that I do really want to get off my chest. I found the opening to this book a bit of a drag, and I mean like the first quarter. Everything up until the point that our main character, Ren, and her Ironsmith companion, Julian, go out on their sort of quest together to rescue the stolen prince. All of the setup, the trial in the woods where Ren is trying to take on her final like bonesmith exam, it's a practical exam, to getting banished to the border fort, to the characters there, to her finally going beyond the wall. Gosh, yes. I felt like that was either... Thing is, I don't feel like it was too long. I feel like, yeah, I get why you need this time to get us there. I just felt like it wasn't good enough. All the characters in this section mean nothing to what I think the actual meat... That's me and bones then. I don't know why I found that funny after what we've just said. The actual meat of the plot, which is the actual adventure. We get a lot of setup. We get quite a lot of time spent on characters. Like, there's a character called Inara, who Ren sets up is her rival at school. They've been going back and forth their entire lives, trying to one-up each other. Ren is sort of the outcast and does what she likes, but Inara is always toeing the line, and, you know, they have this bitter rivalry, and...
You would think that Inara was going to be, like, the Draco Malfoy in this book. Like, she would constantly be there, she would constantly be a thorn in her side, but instead she's there right at the start... And then right at the end, to bookend the book.
And she's like a different character between the two. At the start, I'm like, yes, you're doing a good job. I am hating this Inara. Oh. And at the end, she shows up again and basically has this one heart-to-heart where she's like, actually, Ren, I was just jealous of you because you're such a free spirit.
Yes, talking like human beings talk.
Okay. And she went, I was only really cruel to you because someone else basically... told me to, and I felt threatened, and I'm like,
that
what?
Was a bit predictable though, wasn't it?
That was a bit predictable. And Maisha was like, yeah, but that explains that one incident, but you had this whole rivalry for years, there was so much setup, and you just disappear. It's not even like Ren even thinks about Inara on her journey, or we get flashbacks to like their rivalry. It's heavy emphasis at the very start, and then nothing.
Yeah, I'd say that of the 2 weeks I spent reading this book, the first week was spent getting through the first 20% of earnest reading. Part of that was because I didn't have my cheat code on because I couldn't find an audiobook for this. Even though it does exist, I found it like a week in. I was like, oh, it's been here the whole time. I looked for it but didn't find it. At first, I just assumed that they refused to release an audiobook because they could not find an actor who would say the word bone so many times. I truly wish I could press Control F and find out how many times the word bone is used. But instead, Duncan, I have actually found a good passage to demonstrate this, if you wouldn't mind.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to read a paragraph from the beginning of chapter 2. That was the magic of the bonesmiths. The ability to sense, move, and manipulate dead bones without touch. Within a 10-foot radius, bonesmiths could summon a bone to their hand, guide its movements in midair, or heft bones much heavier than the muscles alone could bear. Valkyrs, like Ren, carried bone weapons. The magic linked them extra speed and strength, as well as pinpoint accuracy. Bonesmiths could see spiritual tethers, the fibers that connected the ghost to its bones that were indistinguishable to the non-bonesmith eye.
Bone! See, I thought that Nikki Paul Preto was actually setting up like a little cheat here, because she says that Ren is a bonesmith, but she's also is it Valkyr?
The audiobook pronounced it Valkyr. It's Reapier and Valkyr.
Brilliant. But, like, this sort of subclass of bonesmith, and I'm like, oh, is this so you don't have to keep saying the word bonesmith? Once again, established at the start, not used through 80% of the novel.
So we talked about, the word bone is used a lot at the start. It's embarrassing. It takes a really long time to get through the section, and I think part of that is just because of the absolute deluge of exposition we get. Really, I mean, the word show, don't tell should just be written all over this book in red marker, because it's genuinely incredible the way in which you have all these different types of magic users, and it's just explained to us again and again and again. This is what they do. This is what this different type does. The goldsmiths are in charge because of this thing that happened in history, and let's do a little paragraph on that. Kind of unforgivable. Like, even compared to something like Children of Blood and Bone, in that, we have Zaylee telling us what all these different clans can do, or rather, what they used to be able to do. She has to tell us because they cannot show us. They can't do this stuff anymore. But in this book, these characters are all active. They still had their powers. So rather than saying, oh, silversmiths are medical users because silver has antimicrobial properties, so they use that to heal people, why don't you just add a silversmith character, even for one scene, like healing people after the bonesmith exam, and just show it? Don't just explain it.
I'm very much in agreement. It's something that bothered me because I sort of looked at it and thought, well, I think you're right, there are easy ways to solve this. Particularly things like you talked about the goldsmiths, and we get sort of this paragraph of their backstory, and like, well, we meet a goldsmith, we meet the prince of the goldsmiths. Why can't you work it into his dialogue? You know, have someone, this is just me speculating here, I know this isn't always the best thing to do when you're critiquing a book, but like, he gets captured at one point, he's talking to like ironsmiths. I'm like, have an ironsmith be like, what makes you think you have like the authority to rule? And then have the prince sort of give this history through like a rebuttal or that kind of conversation, or someone accuse him like, this is the only reason you're royalty, and then you can kind of build some character work alongside your world building. I think that would have worked a lot better.
But this sort of prescriptive approach is found all over the novel, and not just when it comes to unpacking information about characters and history. This is how fight scenes are written as well. Like, there's a bit in it where Ren has to pull off this really daring, difficult technique, which is basically all about, like, letting the ghost charge you, standing completely still, and just, like, stabbing it and letting its mist part around you, and if it touches you once, you're dead. And this is written in this its way where, like, the technique is described to us instead of the action. Like, it's explained exactly the mechanics of how it works and the mechanics of how it's playing out in the moment, instead of just saying, I did this. You know, I grit my teeth and I readied myself like I had 100 times before, and, you know, and steeling my nerves and making it exciting instead of giving us data. I don't want data, I want drama.
And again, a scene like that, have maybe the character do the action, and either we as the reader can just infer, well, yeah, that's part of their magic, they have influence over Bone. Or have another character who maybe doesn't understand the system, like, for example, our ironsmith character, ask them later, what was that? Blah, blah, blah. So I think that's a major kind of component. I don't want to go super negative, but I do want to, there is another point. This is on kind of pointless characters again. I want to swing back round to Geordie. So I just talked a lot, well, previously I talked a lot about Inara, and a character gets lots of build up and then goes nowhere. There's a character in this book that I swear is a name character. They exist for like 3 sentences, and it befuddled me why they were even included. Because when they were introduced, I was like, right, you're someone, you're coming back. What's your role in this? Do you know who I'm talking about, Geordie?
You're talking about Odile?
No, not Odile. Less than Odile. I'm talking about Ren's bunkmate at the border fort, called like Sabina or something.
I don't think she was supposed to be a main character, Duncan. I don't know why you would get that impression.
Not that she's meant to be a main character, but why does she even need to exist? She exists in the scene where the prince falls into Ren's bedroom, and literally she goes, oh, my bunkmate Sabina, not mentioned before this scene, just put her head on the pillow and said, you two do what you two are up to. And then they leave? And I'm like, Duncan, were you friends? Why is she here?
That's allowed. You're, here. You know, you're allowed to just have people who exist in one scene. No crime has been committed.
Oh no, there is a crime. Why is she your bunkmate? Were you friends? Did you have a relationship? Why is this not knocked up? Why is she not there later?
No, Duncan, sometimes when you're a soldier, you have a bunkmate. She's lucky she doesn't have 18 bunkmates.
Well, she could have had more bunkmates if they had character. I'm just so confused why this one person...
Don't get back to the fort later.
She's talking about, like, her friends,
it?
And she's like, what about your bunkmate? Were you not friends? Okay, fine. Maybe not this one.
No, don't... They're not friends. They've known each other for 2 weeks.
What about, then, her Reaper? This was one that I want to stick it to you.
Well, Sonya betrayed her.
I know Sonya betrayed her. But guess what? Rend acts like she doesn't know. It never comes up again. You think that betrayal would knock her for sixes? She's over it in a week.
Just think about her again. That is a fair criticism, but it just did not matter to me. It just didn't matter. That's not stuff I was focused on. I mean, Ren is a lonely character, you know? She has this imperious above-it-all air, but she is very isolated. I think that is a thematically consistent part. Then again, for someone who is, like, lonely and doesn't have any friends, she actually is really good at socializing and making friends. Like, she's a party girl. Like, that's, like, a textual part of her character. She likes to have a good time. But she doesn't have any close friends or companions. That's actually kind of... Yeah, that is a bit noticeable.
It just confuses me so much. You know, they talk about her when she's meeting with the prince. She's like, well, my father wouldn't let me drink before, but I got my alcohol somewhere else. And when she's talking about Junior, she's like, well, obviously I've had a tumble with a man before. Not quite that phrasing, but she shows that she has a bit more experience socializing with people. But none of these people are sort of referenced or thought about. And like you said, she's explained to be very lonely and isolated in our old community. Yet she speaks of experiences that would sort of fly in the face of that. Right, that's all the negative character relationships and the slow beginning. Dordy, any more, and the use of the word bone and the over-explanations. Gosh, these are dampeners, but there is some really fun stuff in here as well. Dordy, let's do a positive. What did you like?
I really like Leo. He was a hoot. At a certain point, the story is mostly told from Ren's perspective, but it does occasionally switch to the other two main characters, Leo and Julian, and Leo's chapters are just a hoot. I found him really funny, I found him charming, I found him compelling. He's an extremely impotent character, but he finds resourcefulness and, small victories where he can, where he's just doing little social moves, where he's the one who's kidnapped. He's this prince. He's the damsel in distress. But he actually has a surprising amount of agency and good humor about the whole kidnapping. Like, we find out... Actually, this is something I didn't like. I thought it was really stupid that he knew he was going to be kidnapped in advance, but made absolutely no moves to try and prevent it. That was weird. But I do like that when he is kidnapped, he sort of like is rolling with the punches. So there's a bit where he's trying to find out more information. And every time he talks, one of them is like, put your hood back on. And he's like, and eventually he's just going, yeah, yeah, yeah. He puts the hood back on and then goes straight back to asking questions. I found that funny. I found it charming.
I completely and utterly agree. He was such a fun character. You're right, he's in this situation where he's been captured. And I love the fact that he identifies things like, okay, so the commander of the guard, that's the one who's always just going to hit me and tell me to be quiet. But that guy, that guy's looking young. He's the new recruit. Okay, he's my easy target. Let's start being friendly with him.
And this all comes to fruition because when he meets with the big bad guy, he actually provides us with a bunch of information that, like, he's put together. And we have, like, a bunch of separate pieces. And then he's the one to connect the dots. And he says out loud to us and the bad guy, okay, so I've actually figured out what your plan is. And I've figured out from these different elements. And I've actually demonstrated that I'm much smarter than anyone in this book or the reader probably realized I am. And that's a pretty good and cool moment.
It's very nice to see. It's something you don't see very often. I find when often you get that character who's like overly buffoonish but meant to be like really clever deep down. Maybe it's portrayed like an act or it's done a little bit too much like two separate personalities. Where with Leo, I think Nicky Paul Bretton does a really good job of making it so it feels completely natural. Like, yes, he's bored, he plays up, he's the prince, he doesn't care. But he has been at court. He is savvy. He knows how to make the small movements to get what he wants and where he's going. I'm just trying to think, so there's another little bit. I like that he does this play in this book, this his kind of grand tactical piece where he starts like spreading rumours. Every time they stop, he like will just chat, you know, to the woman that brings him water or whatever, and it will just be like, you know, have you heard? I think they assassinated the heir to their kingdom.
I'm putting my hand up here, Duncan. I'm asking, that's not my read on it. Maybe I misread this, but my impression was is that he hadn't been doing that, but that's a lie he tells the bad guy. He says, I've been telling people all throughout my journey what your evil plan is when I figured it out, so it's not going to work anymore because I've told everyone. It's not a secret. I thought that was a lie and he hadn't been doing that. Am I wrong about that?
I think you're wrong about that. It's made very clear when he has the first thought about spreading those rumours. A servant comes to where he's being held and he starts shouting, this, I'm not meant to talk to you. And then we have the light bulb moment where he's like, ooh, hang on, what could I say that would be damaging? And then puts together his scheme. So I think he actually was doing that throughout sort of these seaside towns he's been travelling through.
Interesting. I may have fallen asleep when that happened because I do not remember that scene at all.
Very well. So, Leo, thumbs up. But we've got two other key characters in this dynamic triangle. We have Ren and Julian, and they are very much the power couple at the heart of this book.
That's true. I've said the stuff I like about Ren, so I think we should focus on Julian for a
bit. Julian, my man. Julian, he is an ironsmith. He is the heir to the ironsmith throne. He is betrayed by his evil uncle. Just like Ren's evil uncles. Gosh, this author has something against their uncle. I hope it wasn't too bad.
Just really love Hamlet. Lecherous, treacherous, unkindly villain. Oh, ere I should fatten the region's kites with this slave's offal.
Yes, they're all evil, and they're so pure evil as well. But yes, Julian's betrayed by his own.
They are.
Because they want power and to seize the throne. And they didn't even just try to kill Julian, but they killed his father too.
No!
Yeah, very Hamlet, actually. Sorry, where am I going? Julian's betrayed, he falls in with Ren, and they're the natural enemy. And what's kind of fun, I say kind of fun, they butt heads at the start, and the moment these two characters, the moment that Julian ceases to become a faceless enemy, you're like, oh, and you're roughly the same age? Okay, cool, you're together. You're the couple.
No, Duncan, the moment he stepped out onto the field of battle, I was like, okay, yeah, I see how this is going. The moment he shows up and says, and there was a tall figure in a dark suit of armour, and I'm like, just kiss! Shut up!
That was my response through, like, most of their journey. I was like, come on, guys. Come on, guys. The tension's in the air. I quite like the fact that Ren is very much, they both seem very aware there's tension in the air immediately. Like, it's not like, oh, we're suddenly realising our feelings. I think it's pretty much immediate. They're like, okay, I find them hot. I want to get with them. But we're behind.
Yeah, Ren's just horny.
She is. And do you know what? I appreciate
Ren
that.
Ren is just horny. She hasn't had action for a bit. No, I agree. I actually like, again, I like Ren's confidence. I like how she's overconfident. And I like the part of that is that she's sexually confident as well. Like, she knows she's hot. She doesn't act demure and shy about it. I'm glad we skip over that. And she gets to be like, I know that he's into me. Why wouldn't he be?
I just want to take a moment as we're talking about what Ren looks like. I really actually found it delightful when I discovered, so the cover art for this book is an image of Ren in full armour holding out her bone blade with her like shining eyes. She got, and this like this dark makeup around the face. And originally when I, you know, looked at the cover, I'm like, well, yeah, that's the artistic impression. But I love that it's a thing in the world that Ren is applying this black makeup around her eyes.
It's actually like a really important like bit of character work. It's actually like the way in which she chooses to depict herself, you know, it says something about the characters, and the way Julian responds to it says something about their relationship. Like the removal of this after they like fall into a river, like the river is washing away the boundaries between them. It literally washes away like the bits of her armor that she's using to defend herself. It like presents her as a less fearsome and softer visage, and that changes the relation between them. That's all a little bit on the nose, but you know, it's effective.
There's a really sweet moment later as well where they need to sneak into this ironsmith settlement, and Julian offers up like a handkerchief to her to help wipe her makeup off.
Mm.
And again, it's just a very simple thing of showing where they've got to in their relationship and how they feel about each other. Again, really nicely done. So back to Julian.
It is effectively done. It is effectively done. But what we really, I have to harp on is the fact that the moment he appears on the page, and they're not even smooching mode yet. They're still not even up in the fiercely grabbing each other mode. We're still in trying to kill each other. You can tell where the relationship's going. And to be completely frank, that never changes throughout the book. There's never a moment of suspense or mystery or wondering what a character is going to do next. It's so familiar, it's so plain as day, that it did disengage me from the relationship. And as much as, you know, there are cute moments, it never reached a great high. You know, we're not talking about Laszlo and Sarai. We're not talking about a relationship that makes you go, yes, I really want you to be together. To me, even the moments where they're like making out sloppy style, it's never that sensual.
Oh, God.
It's never that sexy.
It won't be if you refer to it as sloppy style. Please never say that again.
Well, we didn't have sex. There's just kissing, and there's making out sloppy style, and then
stop saying sloppy style. I don't know why. I think it's hilarious. Yes, there is a lot of that. I think what I felt here is I was very happy to see these two get together, like particularly because Ren's coming to it with such a passion. I'm like, yeah, you know, just relax, let the boundaries drop, get to know each other. I think one of the things that was slightly disappointing in the relationship is that I never felt like they really got to a point where I was like, yes, you two as characters are compatible people. At no point was I like, yes, Ren and Julian, you shall marry and you will have a happy long life together. Like, there was no, I was like, I don't know if, you know, you're going to break up in 6 months, maybe. Or maybe you'd be together for life, who knows. I know you're going to want to be together for the next 2 weeks. I've got that down.
Yeah, I think that's part of the factor of this book, that it, because it's about this like whirlwind sprint across the country there and back again, it's not something where you can really set up of like a deep growing relationship. So for example, I just read The Warlord Chronicles, and in the second book, it does a surprisingly good job of telling a love story, which is not something I expect of Bernard Cornwell, because it really takes its time. Like, it is soft and slow, and there's a lot of yearning and like watching people from afar and being like, oh, there's plenty of time to spend like agonizing of how do I make them want to be with me. But because they're constantly on this adventure together, those quiet moments of yearning are like minutes spent doing that, not days or weeks of quiet pining. And it just doesn't really allow you to think about, yeah, this is something you've thought about a lot. You haven't had time to actually form a real relationship. And that's, you know, if this were a trilogy, that's what I'd expect from the second book. But it's a duology, so I reckon even then, you're probably going to be sprinting into the next one and rushing to finish it. So, I don't know. I don't have high hopes for, what would his ship name be? Rulian.
Julren?
No, that's not how it works. Duncan, come on. It's pretty clear that which of us has spent a lot of time on Tumblr.com.
Yes, it's very clear. I had another point to follow this up with. I liked them, they were going to be together, not for a long time, they're on the sprint. There's definitely an element, I think, because they're on this sprint and like it was, the danger was so high, that I was mostly just there like, I'll go on, just do it, you might be dead soon. So there's that aspect. Oh, I remember why. Oh, this is a bit negative. Oh, don't know if I want to say it. I've got to say it. A little negative I did find in this is that Julian, when they first meet, does this whole talk about Ren's uncle, secret father, who, he was the devastator, he used his magic, he slaughtered hundreds, he's this feared war criminal in Julian's nation's land. Obviously he's a revered hero.
I don't think we properly made clear that the Ironsmiths and everyone else in the Dominion had a big war, and the Ironsmiths lost, they're actually believed to be like extinct now, so Julian showing up is a big deal.
But when we get this set up, it's very clear that, oh, Ren doesn't reveal who her family is, that she's related to this great war criminal. And I'm just sitting there sort of thinking, great. Now we've got to do the lie reveal moping, how could you keep this from me plot. And I'm not going to lie, that was hanging over this a lot. I was like, God, when's that going to hit? When are they going to have a misunderstanding? When are they going to do something because they think it's in the other's best interest, or not tell them something because they think it's, you know, it will hurt their feelings to know. And then they're not going to like each other. But guess what? They're definitely coming back together. I mean, I haven't read the sequel. Maybe they don't. Maybe Ren ends up with Leo, which now I've said it out loud, I think I would prefer, and I genuinely would give brownie points for.
I disagree, but carry on.
Maybe they should all just realise they're not right for each other and pursue their own paths. I'll give brownie points for that.
I thought you were going to recommend a polycule.
Now, see, already now I've lost where I was going with this.
We'll get to the polycule when we read Iron Widow. Okay, so, you were talking about the lie revealed. Now, Duncan, the lie revealed scene does happen, but it doesn't lean to that big, oh my god, you betrayed me, oh, we have inseparable differences. That scene does happen, but it's completely unrelated. Did that mitigate your feelings about the lie revealed scene?
It did, quite a lot. I was, weirdly, almost already had hurt the book, because I was so anxious of this scene happening. When it didn't happen, I was like, oh, well, I wish I knew that wasn't happening. I've been so under a dark cloud for so long. That was nicely done. At least it was quick.
I came at it differently.
Ooh.
Yes, it was quick. I don't think I got as bent out of shape about this as you did. So there's that. But I really disliked the disagreement scene. I just felt like the whole conflict was extremely manufactured. And the only reason it worked is I feel like Julian had kind of read the book ahead of time. Julian has a very good reason to not cross over into the Dominion territory. He's like the lead. He's one of the leaders of the enemy faction. He'll be arrested. And he has good reasons not to trust them. So that's legit. And the others can say, well, we'll vouch for you. We'll say you're our friend and that you helped us. And to which Julian should say, yeah, but I kidnapped a prince. They're not going to forgive that. They were survivors. Like, my group killed your guys. I'm going to go to prison forever. I can't come with you. Instead, what the discussion is Julian says, you can't trust any of those people. No one in the whole Dominion can be trusted, apparently. No one will act for your own best interest. They'll all tell you lies. Which is, on its face, an absurd thing to say. It just so happens to be completely true. So the twist here is that Julian says something that seems completely unreasonable, only to be proven right. And you can never predict this unless you've read another, you know, four other books. So this is the very frustrating part for me, is that I just want this bit to hurry up, because I know what's going to happen. They're going to ditch Julian, they're going to leave him behind. And then the only thing that surprised me at the ending is that Julian is immediately captured instead of coming in to rescue them at the end. That was the one thing that surprised me. Everything else, word for word, I predicted.
I certainly knew that some of the characters would be betraying them. The obvious ones were selected. You're a little bit exaggerating there. Only like the high ups in the Dominion are like, we are secretly evil.
Yes,
Commander,
that's true.
Duncan is honest.
There are some people who are not.
And all Duncans are.
Duncan, I bet you're pleased that for once a Duncan is not being murdered in this book. Because there was a Duncan in The Straight Razor's Cure, and he got his throat slit.
Yeah, and obviously King Duncan had a bad end. And the only other Duncan I can think of off the top of my head, I think it's in Dragon Age Origins, the video game, and he doesn't make it past the opening. Hard name.
Don't forget Sir Dunk from the Knights of Seven Kingdoms. Except I think he does die tragically in the expanded history of Westeros.
Yes, Sir Duncan the Tall, Captain of the King's Guard, he dies in the, I believe it's the Great Fire at Summerhall. You want to get into the lore.
Naturally, thank you, Duncan.
But not in his book. He survives his book Anyway, yes, Commander Duncan, it's not like everyone's evil, although I do like the fact that, like, the leader of the big bad, Renfather, Vance, they make a big deal out of the fact that you've got, like, the henchmen who are, like, at the border fort, but Vance also has, like, his personal guard, who are blindly loyal and in on the evil, or just so blindly loyal they don't care. I find it weird, this, like, this two-tier system. I just always find it weird when villains have henchmen who are, like, why are you following this guy? He's not even in your interests. How did he get a group of you who are also just like, yes, let's betray the heir to the throne. I'm on with that.
How? I don't know how in the know they are. I don't think they know about, like, the full ghost conspiracy, right?
Well, they know about Iron Revenant.
Like, they just told...
like, the guy's buying these things and these, like, iron golems are rocking up. Surely that's a hint. And, like, a corpse woman shows up for negotiations.
Ravenna's the one. Oh, no, sorry, you're referring to the Regents, yes. Guys.
Sorry, I did jump characters there.
Yeah, I mean, you did jump characters there in a confusing way, but they have a good reason to buy Iron Revenants because they want revenge against the Dominion.
Yeah, I suppose you're right. Just seems weird that everyone's always in on it.
The kind of unconvincing part of a lot of this book is the mustache twirlingness of its villains. Like, the regent, the Julian's uncle, whose name also starts with J. I forget what it is, though. James? Anyway, he's so evil. And, like, in a way that it's like, yes, my boy, of course I betrayed you. Just like I betrayed your father!
I know, and I love the fact that his whole justification is like, because I am the strong, and only the strong will rule, and I will release an army of the dead and revenge. Like, he can have...
Your father was too weak, Julian! I had to take his place, and you had to be removed as well!
No, I love the fact he basically says at one point, he's like, he was too compassionate and caring for the common people. His compassion was his weakness.
Just like your mother! I'm sorry. I'll stop with this silly voice. But yeah, it's crazy. And this happens in reverse at the end, because Vance doesn't give any crazy evil speeches. So he has Odile do the whole, you're mad! Your idea is just crazy! And now I will list out all of the evil things you've ever done in a conversation which I don't know the main character is overhearing, so that I can exposit all of the bad stuff that you've done! You, the villain! And now allow me to explain the death of your, maybe sexual partner, but also your brother's sexual partner, who then gave birth to the main character, and I'm going to deliver this dialogue in an extremely clunky and lengthy way, which feels extremely unnatural. I didn't like the ending of this book, if you hadn't picked that up.
That's the other point I would kind of bring up. I had issues with, like,
I like the middle, and a climax, and that's
I think the first quarter and, like, the last eighth, I was a bit iffy on, but that still leaves 5/8, which was solid.
Yes. You're right. That's fair. The first quarter and the first 20% and the last eighth, not that great.
Sorry, I feel like we've gone on negatives again. What's this like?
That was our positive section.
I'm going to jump point. Okay. So those are some of the downsides. Let's jump over, though, to a bit I really liked. I really liked when our two main characters, Ren and Julian, are travelling across this area known as the Breach. This great crater that opened in the ground and all the dead spilled out of. And they're cutting across the breach because they're trying to catch up with the kidnappers, and they're kind of heading them off at the turn by going through the dangerous territory that no one would dare go because there are too many undead about. Firstly, I thought the undead were quite a fun. I cringed a little bit at the literal tier system. It's a tier 1 ghost, it's a tier 2 ghost, it's a tier 3. I've never fought a tier 5 before.
It's a hard magic system. What are you going to do?
But I like the descriptions. I like the fact that they can be very ethereal, a light green mist. I like the idea that they just need to touch you and get this, like, death rot.
Yeah.
And I do quite enjoy some of the fights with them. They weren't brilliant, but I like the fact that Ren was throwing out, like, a bone dust to make, like, a spray. A bone deters the undead. That's a key, the ghostly undead, that's a key plot point. So does moving, so yeah. does water. Why does Arthur Castle not have a moat? Anyway.
The actual thing, they can't cross running water. I liked this idea a lot, is that they can't leave the ground. You know, magic comes from the earth, so they can't, like, they can't take any kind of step. Like, they couldn't go up a ladder, for example. If you climb up a ladder, you're completely safe. You climb a rope, you're safe. If you cross, you know, not even a river, a puddle, if it stretches across a space, they can't go through it.
Which I think is some really cool rules. I would love to have, sorry, go down negatives. Damn it, Duncan. I would love to have seen this maybe reflected a bit more in the world architecture. Like, we have actual societies where people, you know, you build your houses up high or in have tree houses or house on stilts. You know, could this be implemented more?
You could see that on the other side of the Dominion, where they don't have Valkyrs and Reapers. Maybe the houses are built differently. You know, like you could say, no one lives on the ground floor of this house. They all have to live on the second floor, and they removed the stairs and replaced it with a rope. Or you can say all of the buildings look fine at the bottom, but they have like these shanty towns on the roofs, and they've built like a second village above, like above a so that the ghosts can't get them. That would be really cool and interesting, but that doesn't really manifest. And nor is the I gotta say, you know, it's only just occurred to me this moment. There's a very dramatic scene, probably one of the most exciting scenes in the book. It's all about this chase across an iron bridge. How the fuck did the ghost cross that bridge?
Oh, you've just got me. Were the ghosts, there's a special type of ghost called like a revenant, where the ghost is bound and it's still bound in its flesh.
They can't cross rivers.
I think they can. Were those the ghosts in question?
They were revenants, yes, but revenants can't cross rivers.
No, there must be a height limit to rivers, though.
Well, I'm not talking about the river blocking them. I'm saying that they, you know, they need contact with the earth. That's what stops them from proceeding. But the bridge is not the earth, right? Like,
yeah.
if they can climb.
No, but revenants,
I think, bypass the rules. Rope ladder.
No, but what I'm saying is, it's because they're revenants, they don't care for
the
rules.
No, but the revenants are stopped by the river.
Yes. But if they're really motivated, they can ignore the rules.
I don't think that's true, Duncan.
I think it might be. Maybe this was a part not overly explained.
Duncan, there's a scene where they're in the river and the ghosts can't get them.
True, but there's a scene where the revenant enters a town over a drawbridge. So this happens more than once. Revenants can just do it.
We're getting dealing with some floor is lava rules. So what the floor is, the ground, the earth is... I guess it literally is just that, like, can't lift both feet above the ground. Like, if one foot is on the ground, that's okay. So that means that they can't climb ladders because 2 feet would be off the ground? That doesn't make any... Whatever. That doesn't make any sense. That's weird. The bridge is ground. We've decided. The bridge, despite the fact it's not made of soil or earth, it's ground.
Well, this isn't what makes me think. If you built a stone keep, could they walk up a stone keep?
What do you mean by up? Because they can't climb walls. We know that.
No, they can't climb walls. But if you had a stone... If you built like a tower out of stone, and stone is earth, could a ghost walk up the stairs?
I think ghosts can walk upstairs.
Okay.
Yeah.
But they can't... But they can't, like, ethereally fly.
Duncan, I don't think it's a question of what is earth. I think it's a question of what is floor.
Okay, so they still obey gravity. Despite being, like, spectral spirits, ghosts still obey the rules of gravity, is what we're saying.
Yes, they can't... Ghosts can't fly. They always walk. It's also explained at one point that the ghosts move like spooky Japanese ghosts. So they're all herky-jerky.
Oh my gosh, yes, you're right. I'd actually forgotten that. And I think if I had that in the back of my mind, it would have been creepier throughout the book. Because that... I don't like that. That actually really... puts me off, you know, the ring level of not right movement. Ugh.
Yes. Yes, that could have been creepy. The reason why you forgot that, Duncan, is that the tier system is introduced in Chapter 2, where they start fighting ghosts for the first time. And Tier 1 is a completely passive form of ghost. It's basically just like an evil mist. Tier 2 is like not dangerous at all. It has a solid form, but it's too stupid to attack. 3 is where it can start fighting you and you have to fight back. And then 4 is like a reasonably dangerous non-corporeal ghost. And then tier 5 is revenants. And revenants are ones that are so animated that they're still attached to their corpse. They have a corporeal form, they have physical strength. And they're like, they're zombies, you know, they can move, they can run, they're fast zombies, but they're not supposed to have intellect. The problem is that means that we go straight from fighting ghosts to fighting walking corpses. So Ren never fights. She fights twice, 2 times in the book, these non-corporeal actual ghosts, like see-through, glowing green, and the rest of the time it's walking corpses. This presents a couple of problems for the narrative. One of them is that we literally go straight from like 0 to 100. She has a little practice fight in chapter 2 and 3 against non-corporeal ghosts, and she struggles against them. She goes across the wall and she's immediately fighting tier 5s and nothing else. There's one other fight against a non-corporeal, what she does, but for the rest of it, it's just tier 5s. The most dangerous ones all the time.
Yes, it's quite interesting to introduce the tier system, but I don't feel like we really get a sense of it ramping up. I think what would have been really cool to see is maybe like have a fight that Ren wins against like a 4, but have it be like a real struggle. Like she's pulling out all the stops, this is a really close call. And then when the 5 gets rolled out, then you go, oh my gosh, she only just survived the 4, and now we've got the level 5.
Duncan, you're describing Bleach, but yes, that's what you should do. You have it be a major struggle to fight the lieutenant, and then Captain Kenpachi shows up.
I mean, there is...
It's a story about fighting ghosts. Of course we're going to bring up Bleach.
I miss Bleach. I miss good Bleach.
Are you following the Thousand Year Blood War arc?
No, I probably should. I'm probably not going to have... Is that's on Disney Plus, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, I'm probably not going to renew Disney Plus this year. They've cracked down on their password sharing and they've put up their prices again, and I think I'm out. I literally only ever watch their Star Wars TV shows, and last year I didn't even watch the Acolyte. I just watched Skeleton Crew, which is amazing, by the way. Please, people, go out, watch Skeleton Crew.
Really?
It's incredible. I thought it was really good. Everyone said, oh, it's Goonies in space. I'm like, yes, it's Goonies in space. It's really well done. I know there's been some critique that in the first episode, the planet they're on looks quite like earthy. Firstly,
who cares?
It always looks like it. They're filmed on Earth. You know, Endor was a forest. I've seen loads of them. I don't really buy into that critique. But when they're actually out in the world, it's such a fun cast of characters. And these are young actors doing amazing jobs. And it really kind of hurts me that we finally got something that I think is really good out of Star Wars. And all that dominates the conversation is the fact that it had like no views. Kind of heartbreaking.
I had no idea that anyone had even watched it. No one has ever discussed it in front of me. Thank you for letting me know that, Duncan. Maybe I'll watch a bit of Skeleton Crew. I probably won't, because Star Wars is for nerds. But back to our YA fantasy novel. All right. We talked about good stuff. We talked about the fighting. We talked about the stuff and the fighting we didn't like. I'll say one more thing about this. As a general rule, to go back to Bleach straight away, I don't like whip swords. I think they're stupid. This is the one time I thought, this makes sense. I think you're a character who could use a whip sword. Yeah, so you believe that he wouldn't just slice his own carotid artery and die after swinging it, and he can use it for Indiana Jones stuff. So he uses it to, like, he whips it out, and it, like, attaches to stuff, and you're like, that makes sense, because this sword has, like, segmented bits, and it makes sense that they would, like, bind together and get stuck. and it makes sense that he can use that same grappling ability in a non-lethal way, because he can control the way the whip lands. He can make it, like, even if it doesn't bind together, he just hardens it, and it, like, stays put, and it grips onto Ren when she, like, falls off a ledge. Believable, good, like it, done.
An undeniable positive, and that's a great scene when they're escaping across this bridge. Ren...
It is.
Falls through a plank. He whips out his sword. He's holding her, dangling below. The dead are coming onto them. They don't have much time. He's trying to pull her up. They, like, look into each other's eyes. But oh no, it's starting to slip at the last second. Will Ren fall? It's really nice.
And you're doing the classic, you have to let me go, drop me. No, I won't do it. What I really like about that, scene is that this separates the two characters, and what I'm waiting for is for both of them to sort of be stewing in their guilt separately, and then, like, running to each other way later. What happens instead is Julian shows up in the next chapter, because the moment he, like, got away after she fell, he sprinted down the mountainside to be like, I gotta go get her! And he's like, are you okay? I'm so sorry! I feel really bad that I dropped you! That's novel. That's different. I've never seen an extremely familiar scene happen like that.
And what was so great about this scene, and I think you just tipped around it there, but I just want to make it very clear. When Julian gets back to Ren, one of his key things is he needs Ren to know that he didn't drop her on purpose.
Yes.
Like, that's right. What mattered to him is that he needed her to know that she wasn't being betrayed by him. And I was actually like, well, this is actually a really big step for your relationship. In a more general sense, like,
yeah, it's convincing to me.
It shows that Julian cares what Ren thinks about him, and in a really good, like, in a really well way, a way I don't often see. The idea, the real concern, obviously Ren's well-being, the fact that Ren could sit there thinking he betrayed her is the worst thought in his mind. Amazing stuff.
Social anxiety, I get it. Yeah. That was a good scene, and it makes sense that their relationship takes a big step forward after that. That's convincing. That's pretty good.
While we're down there, after they fell off the bridge into the chasm, no pun, they discover this sort of city of ghostsmiths. And ghostsmiths, titled the second book, is this long-lost smithing art where these people, shockingly, control ghosts and control the undead, and it's obviously incredibly powerful, given this is a world where the dead always rise. This is actually quite a nice bit of the plot. I like this bit of world building, that, like, the dead always rise, so in the Dominion, they have to send out the bonesmiths to make sure they don't when someone dies, but also on the other side of the wall, where the ironsmiths are, they have all these ways of, like, dealing with dead bodies. Like, they try, like, throwing them into the sea, and, like, burning them to, like, try and make the ghost not come back. I like that element. I always think there's a little conversation about, like, do other creatures get ghosts? And I think there's a bit where,
but only, like, warm-blooded creatures.
Yes. How interestingly specific.
How did this get more register you, Duncan, as a vegetarian?
I mean, vegan.
Oh, that's right. You've upgraded. I forgot.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I
obviously, all creatures are equal. If I say evil, then that's a bit weird. All creatures are equal.
All creatures bear original sin, as we know. So they should all be baptized. Duncan, I only eat non-baptized creatures. So, that means I eat Buddhists all the time. That's the stupidest joke I've made in this podcast.
Yeah, it was. Well done. Finally distracted me from what you said earlier. What was it? Messy, squishy. What did they do?
Making out sloppy style.
Sloppy style. Jesus Christ. Yes, making out sloppy style. Yes. It's only warm-blooded creatures, but they make a point where if you, like, butcher animals properly or in the right time. I just would like to know a bit more about how this world works, because I'm like, so if someone's like you, no one dies alone in this world. Like, if someone's on their deathbed, or, like, there's an elderly relative in the community, people must just watch them like a hawk. Like, okay, they're dead. Quickly, get the people in. Get the bonesmiths in.
Yeah, I mean, the silversmith must just have them on speed dial to be like, okay, go get them.
I tried. Oh my god, can you imagine that if you're in like the hospital ward and you know you've been treated by the silversmith and then he just stands up and the bonesmith comes over. He's just like, oh, I'm not going to make it, am I? And the bonesmith's like, no.
Oh, that's sad. Yeah, hospice care is this, you just take you to the bonesmith house. You're like, oh, it's so gaudy. It's covered in bones. It's everywhere. What was I about to say? Yeah, you don't get a lot of taste of actually living in this world because it's all, again, described to us distantly, and then she leaves the world behind. She goes into this other space, and she doesn't even spend time in, like, the Ironsmith villages. Obviously, most of them are dead, but, like, the beyond the Dominion villages. She goes to one. But the rest of the time, she's just in the wilderness and in, like, Ghostsmith places. So you don't actually get a sense of, like, community, a sense of society. You know, they're fighting for these big, for peace between, like, disparate lands, and these aren't real places. They're empty.
We do go to this Ghostsmith fallen city, this necropolis. And in here, we get this kind of major, I'd say, plot element, hook, maybe, for the next novel, you could describe it as. This is, like, Well of Magic, we discover. And in this scene is when we find out that, or first hinted at, we basically find out, it's blooming obvious at this point.
It's just a foghorn going, brother! Twin brother! To be fair, when he was first introduced, I'm like, little brother. But then the big twist is, twin brother. Extra spooky. What do we find down there, Duncan?
We find there is a well of magic, a literal well of it. It is like a whitey, misty stuff. And there is Ren's twin brother, but we don't know that yet. But we know that because they have the same ring. They were separated from birth. They each got a magic ring. Anyway, and he's making the revenants for their mother, who is the corpse queen. And they're all evil. But he has a moment with Ren because Ren discovers she can control the undead. And magic comes from the land. And they must dig to get at the magic, because magic is in the ground, Audi. So the deeper you delve, the greater magic you find.
Do you think his name is going to be Hawk? Because he points at a ring and it's like, Bird of Prey. And then he points at a songbird and he goes, that's you, Ren.
I mean, I do think that's going to be the case. The only bet there is what bird is it going to be? Falcon.
I hope he's called California Condor.
And now, so do I. So, we get this discovery, and this is what's set up for the next book. This book actually basically ends on the character of Ren setting out to destroy the source of magic. Are you excited for that, Jordan?
No, I'm not. I'm not going to read the next book. Are we moving to... Is this the end of the episode? Is it snuck up on me completely? I mean, Duncan,
no,
I'm
there is
not
something I did like here. A bit of world building.
Okay, fine.
I know it's dropped an exposition, but I do actually like this little element. It is established that this source of magic comes from the ground, and we find this literal the well of magic. One thing that we also do touch on is the fact that only this island has magic. Like, this is the larger world going on.
Oh yeah,
but
that's
they
right.
Don't all have magic. Like, literally, by being on this island, you become more magical. And it's even inferred that the people who live near the source of the material become the smiths. So, like, all the bonesmiths are descended from, like, gravediggers.
Yeah, some sort of weird magical osmosis. They were born from I mean, this is stupid, because there's the distinction bone and ghost is always pretty nebulous in this. So the goldsmiths, they were born next to a gold mine. The silversmiths were born next to a silver mine. You can guess the rest. Bonesmiths were gravediggers, but the first ghostsmith owned a cemetery?
Yes.
Why are these different? Is it literally just proximity to being in the dirt and not being in the dirt? Is that what made the big difference?
I'm not even sure what difference I would have liked to have seen. It seems a bit odd. I have nothing else to say.
I want to know, why are goldsmiths actually the ones in charge? Because surely the ability to find large amounts of gold would actually devalue gold. I guess they can just control gold, and therefore, like, not control gold like metal bend it. I mean, like, hide it and decide what the value of it is.
I can only assume that they, firstly, control supply, so they force a level of rarity? And also what I'd love to know, were the goldsmiths the miners who seized means of production who were actually near the gold, or were they just the mine owner?
Duncan, what do you think about silversmiths having antimicrobial powers, so their role as being the healer?
Listen, Geordie, I'm not going to pretend that I know in depth how medicine works, but I do think there is a level of bollocks to that, because as far as I'm aware, if their powers are like any of the other people, all they can do is, to put it in Avatar terms, as you just said, is bend the material. And I'm like, well, if I've got a wound, filling it with silver isn't gonna do anything to it.
So silver is quite good for working on like surface wounds. So you can, for example, if you have a cut, you can put colloidal silver on it, and I think it is good for preventing infection. But you're right, you can't close a wound, so you'd be really good at preventing infection. But do they know what germs are? They had the word antimicrobial.
Germ theory, like, is real.
So they know what microbes are. They have germ theory. But how? Like, because they wouldn't need to research this if they had a magical means. This is nitpicking. This is not a real complaint. This is just something that's fun to think about. They don't need to do medical research to find out what germs are, because they can just cure it using magic. So there's no reason to find out what microbes are. So they probably don't know what germs are. So why? So sometimes they'd be like, I'm pumping so much silver into this guy, but he's still dying because they don't know what a fungal infection is. Or they don't know what cancer is, because you can't cure cancer with silver. People have tried. They're dead. And they're blue.
Okay, that took a turn. Yes, this seems a little bit ridiculous, although
people trying to sell you colloidal silver are monsters. Don't listen to them.
All I'm going to add to this at this point is that I watched Avatar The Last Airbender. I watched Legend of Korra. I love them both very dearly. And in that universe,
the next series has been announced.
I know, I'm so excited. I cannot wait. This is actually, I can't even know when Korra finished. It feels like, obviously Korra, it's like it came afterwards. It feels more modern, but at the same time, so long ago.
I think 2015, gosh, maybe 2014.
Yeah, that probably does line
Damn,
up.
That's a long time ago.
The point I'm getting at is that in that universe, waterbenders can heal with just holding water over wounds. So if I let that slide, I'll let the silver smith slide. Also, we don't actually see any of them. They're only referenced off page.
No, yeah. Duncan, I'm ready to end this episode.
I am too. And I've got a bit of a funny statement to make my ending on. I think I'll... Can you go first? Because I think I'll be more positive.
I think you will be more positive. Okay. I mentioned at the start of this episode that I re-listened to our episode on Sisters of Sword and Shadow. And I'm glad I did for a lot of reasons. I really feel like that was a good coincidence of destiny. In fact, there were a couple of weird coincidences which lined up with my reading of this book. One of them was the fact I listened to that episode again, and in it, we talk about how, you know, that book, as a sort of introduction to feminist literature, it sort of serves a function. It works well, because if you've never read a book like that before, and it's introducing you to new ideas around feminism, that's a really useful book. If you have experienced those ideas before, it doesn't actually serve you a lot of value, and it's not really worth your time. In this book, you got something similar, because this is a really familiar story. You have seen this story before. And if you haven't, you might well enjoy this book. And if you have seen this 100 times before, if you've read it and enjoyed it 100 times, you'll enjoy reading it again. But I experienced something else this week. I listened to a Tim Minchin song that I've never heard before. It came out last year. It was made to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Sydney Opera House. It's called Play It Safe. It's this song that tells you as an audience, don't try and have cool original ideas. Just give people what they want. Toe the line, don't It says, don't try and come up with these bold new ideas. Just do what everyone else does, because then no one will point and stare at you. And obviously by telling you to do all this stuff, by barking these instructions at you, it's criticizing you, it's telling you, be bold, have great new ideas, do something exciting and dangerous and weird, and be brave about doing it. So I was kind of primed after hearing that song and listening to it over and over, because it's an earworm, that this book to me, it's kind of reprehensible.
I strongly disagree.
I'm sure you do, Duncan. I'm sure you do. Because this book is fine. You know, it's fine. And if you've read it 100 times before, you'll enjoy it again. But if you have read it 100 times before, don't read this book. Just don't. Just read something else. You know, if you're thinking about picking up Bonesmith, just try something different. Just be a little bold, be a little weird, try something strange. That's what I gotta say.
There's nothing wrong with doing things by the book, if you do it well. One of my favourite video games is Dragon Quest VIII. PS2, classic. Dragon Quest wrote the book on JRPGs. It does very little new, but it does it very, very well. Another great story. Let's talk about one of my top authors, Robert E. Howard. He wrote 21 Conan stories. He was plagiarising himself by the end, but he was doing it well, and they're still enjoyable. Bonesmith does very little new, nothing that you wouldn't have seen before, that you wouldn't have predicted, but it does it well enough. I mentioned at the start how when we did Green Rider, I called it a 10 out of 10, 7 out of 10. This is a 6 out of 10, 7 out of 10. 7 out of 10 is now shorthand for YA fantasy.
Yeah.
It does what really matters well. And I don't think that's been emphasised enough. I think if you are a fan of this fiction, go for it. You know you like it. It's fine to have comfort food once in a while. And it isn't bad. It's not insulting. The ideas aren't dangerous, they're not rude. In fact, some of the aesthetic is
they're not dangerous. You're
quite
right.
Enjoyable because there is a bit of a unique flavour. It looks different. It's black vanilla ice cream. You know how vanilla ice cream with a charcoal in it? It tastes like vanilla ice cream, but it looks different. That's Bonesmith. Yeah, it's the same, but it's got a bit of its own aesthetic going on. I think you'll remember it, not in great detail, but if you saw on the shelf, you'd go, I read that. And you'll probably be able to recount the plot, maybe because it's like all the other ones you've read. But it's still enjoyable. I will be honest, I'm probably not going to read the next in the series. Maybe if it's cheap on Kindle. And I think that's a bit of a shame, because this...
Because you've already read it.
No, because this book does have, you know, it's just the first part of the story. It very much feels like part one, but unlike some maybe like, I don't know, Children of Blumbone, well, like, oh, where is it going to go? I know where it's going to go. If it surprises me, well done to it, but it gets the job done, and there's nothing wrong with that. I enjoyed my time with it. It wasn't a drag. In fact, it went quite quickly for me. I knocked out that first quarter in 2 days, and the rest of the series I read at a nice even pace. Do you know what? It's nice to have a book that you're not thinking too much. You can just relax into what's happening. I enjoyed my time with Bonesmith, and I think listening to this episode, you will know. You know if you want to enjoy your time too. If you have even the inkling, you're probably right. And likewise, if you have the, if you're just sitting there like, oh, I'm not sure, the answer's no. Like, if you want to break into YA, this is not the place to start. Although at the same time, by making it the place to start, it's actually to be the best.
Yeah, no, but this is a fine introduction as well. Yeah, I mean, it's better than a lot of the other stuff. Like, I'd recommend this over Throne of Glass and, like, the subsequent Children of Blood and Bone books. I wouldn't recommend it over Children of Blood and Bone. I'd recommend you to read that first book and then just, like, rip out the last page and just be like, happy ending, hooray!
I'm certainly not put off by this author. I would read more from them. I don't know, it's better than Malice.
I...
Yeah.
Is it better than Malice? I'm not so sure about that. It's better written.
Well, what more are you asking of a book, Geordie?
Fucking hell. I don't know how to compare. Well, here's something I forgot to say earlier, Duncan, is that this book is more competently written than Sisters of Sword and Shadow. But you should read Sisters of Sword and Shadow before you
no,
read this.
No, I disagree.
That book has something to say.
No, it doesn't.
No, that book has something to say. That book has a reason to exist. This book, you know...
No, stop right there. Nothing that in the world is would insulting. Change. Right, Geordie, sometimes people consume media. Like, if you want to read something because it has something to say, you would be... Go and read an actual textbook or work of great philosophy. We're consuming a lot of fantasy media because it's enjoyable. This book is enjoyable. Why... What...
It is enjoyable, yes. But it's an opiate, you know? There are... And you can find it 100 times over. Go to your bookshop. Go to the YA... Yes. The YA section. Look at the fantasy section there. Pick anything off the shelf. You'll get the same experience.
Exactly.
If you've read all of them before, don't go on and read this one too. You've already had that experience.
Agree. You enjoy it.
At a certain point,
I enjoy The Hobbit. I'm not going to tell... No, better example. You enjoy Lord of the Rings. Oh, well, no point reading Wheel of Time or the Rift War saga then. It's the genre.
That's not comparable.
It's comparable.
Those aren't comparable to Lord of the Rings.
This book, you're right, maybe it doesn't do enough to stand out from the crowd.
They're inspired by Lord of the Rings,
but it's just as good as the crowd. In fact, it's competently written. Of all those books in the YA section, if I was standing there with a friend and he's like, I want to read one of the books in the YA section, I'd look at it and go, well, listen, they're all quite similar and they're going to be on a spectrum of bad to good. But you know what? I know that Bonesmith is definitely closer to the good end of the spectrum. That'd be a safe bet for you, mate. And they go, oh, thank you. I was like, yeah, we'll push through the first quarter and it gets better after that. And off they go.
If you are someone who used to read a lot, remember we said this recently for Dalek at Dream Department Store? Not an amazing book, but easy to get into. If you're someone who used to read a lot, you're looking for something that's enjoyable, that's easy to get into, I'd recommend this one. I'd recommend this one quite hard. I think you will enjoy yourself. If you exclusively read Sarah J. Maas, Jennifer Armentrout, stuff like that...
Here's another book you'll love.
Don't read this book. It won't change anything about your life. You've already experienced that, and you can experience it in so many other ways. And maybe it's unfair that I've chosen this one to say that about, because I could bring it up about Fourth Wing. I could bring it up about Throne of Glass. I could bring it up about... I've forgotten... I don't know enough about Iron Widow to throw that in there, so...
But surely, Geordie, we could go back in
time. You know
what
you should do instead of reading this book? Go for a hike! Go to a painting class!
You enjoy reading! Read something you enjoy! This is like going back and being like, oh, you read Harry Potter? Well... Don't bother reading any other Person Goes to Special School novel. You've already read one. It's a genre. It's fine to enjoy it. Even if this one is a bit paint by numbers.
I'm not ruling out this book completely. Duncan, what do you think the author was trying to say with this book?
Hey guys, I wrote another YA fantasy novel. Would you like to read it?
Yes, exactly. Like, it's... You know what this is? It's content.
You said that weirdly scathingly.
It's not art.
Pay Netflix
it's
every month
art.
For content.
Yeah, but there's good stuff.
Not that I'm watching.
Well, don't pay for Netflix, Duncan. What can I say? You know, you only have so much time in your life. You only have so much time you can commit to sitting down to read. Why read Bonesmith?
Because I like it.
If you've read...
And people out there will like it too.
Okay.
Yes, you could go on expedition to Mount Everest. But if you enjoy classic YA fantasy literature, you are not going to regret your time with Bonesmith any more than you probably regret your entire life.
Read Strange the Dreamer.
Oh, yeah.
Read something that's a little bit outside your bubble. Just step outside the familiar.
And then when you don't like it, know that you can come back and read Bonesmith.
if you want, Duncan, sure, if you want to retreat and go back into Plato's cave, you can do that. But take a look outside.
My girlfriend has a t-shirt.
You know what the thing of is about, why he shows the word content? Content keeps you content. And why would you want to be anything except content?
Exactly. I just want to say my girlfriend actually has a t-shirt that literally just has the words, Plato, please let me back in the cave. It's the top person I'm with. Well, I'm not explaining Plato's cave, so I'm going to wrap up now. You know my thoughts. I think we all know Geordie's.
That's for philosophy. Geordie. I'm going to go listen to Tim Minchin again.
Well, before you do that, why don't you tell us what we're reading next week? Oh, he who wants to step outside his comfort zone.
So, before I read this book, I had a plan for what I was going to read. And I even told Duncan, because I said, like, we have to do it at some point. So let's just do it now. And that was going to be Fourth Wing. But I just can't bring myself to
not
do
after
it.
His recent
It wouldn't be fair to... I mean, that's part of it, but also, it wouldn't be fair to Rebecca Yarros. I wouldn't be going into it in a fair state of mind, because I would just be thinking of it as more, you know, slop for the masses. So, I'm gonna do one which I think is gonna be a good book. I've checked. My girlfriend doesn't think this is fantasy, but most people seem to agree that it is. And I've chosen Watership Down.
Okay, I'm just going to let you in now that I haven't read the book. I have seen the film, and I would agree with your girlfriend, but let's see what the book has to offer.
I mean, it's about... I think it is a fantasy. It's in the style of an epic. That's definitely in its favour. It's like Beowulf or Rabbit.
That is a great description, and I hope that holds true. I love having the argument, what is fantasy?
So far, I've selected 100% of the books that we have, after reviewing them, said, okay, that probably wasn't actually fantasy. And I'm willing to take that risk again. It's either that or we do Sight, which is a book I read when I was a kid and I liked a lot. That's also exclusively about animals, but at least one of the animals is definitively a psychic who can see the future, past and present.
To be fair, if the animals talk, talking animals aren't real. They're fantastical, so it must be fantasy. There we go.
That's what I'm saying. I think the style of it is more significant here, the way the rabbits have mythology.
Right.
But I'm looking forward to this. I've never read it before. People say it's great. I'm interested.
I look forward to finding out with you. So, if you have listened to our rambling rants going back and forth and want to pitch in, please, please do so. The best place, as always, is on our Instagram, This Is Just Fantasy Podcast. Love to hear your comments. It really makes my day. You can also email us at itsafantasypodcast@gmail.com. Let us know. Do you like Bonesmith? Do you like YA? Do you think this is a good example of YA? I would love to hear your thoughts. I would really love to hear people go, right, I do love YA, but these are the YA books that I kind of recommend over Bonesmith, if you fall down that line. Or if you think Bonesmith is a great time, give me your arguments. I can throw it in Georgie's face.
Duncan, if someone said to you, I'm a really big movie fan, and you said, okay, tell me about the movies you like, and they exclusively mentioned movies that were either Die Hard or inspired by Die Hard, like Olympus Has Fallen, London Has Fallen, I can't think of any more, but there's a lot of them, you know what I mean, Speed 2.
I'm really sorry, Geordie.
Would you say they're actually a fan of cinema, or would you encourage them to watch other types of action movies?
Yeah, I would tell them to step outside their comfort zone, but... like, if they do step outside their comfort zone and watch some big, emotionally driven, beautiful piece of cinema. For some reason, the example in my head at the moment is The Shawshank Redemption. Whereas, like, obviously, you know, do go for it. But there's no problem with watching something going, okay, wow, oh gosh, I have a new perspective. But guess what? Sometimes you're tired. You've had a long day. You just want to cuddle up and have something that's comforting. And Bonesmith is comforting. And the thing is, it is well written. It's not amazingly written, but it's well written. It's delivering what you want to a standard of quality that I find very acceptable.
But Duncan, there are people out there who only read this type of book. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not creating a straw man. That's just the way it is. you know, this is served up. This has been published because it fits into market trends. It's palatable. It's safe. People read stuff like this because it's safe. In the same way that there are people out there where the only movies they go and see are Marvel films.
And by the same way,
there's nothing wrong with enjoying a Marvel movie. But you gotta learn. You gotta step out. You gotta experience like the wonderful opportunities that are out there.
And in the same way, Geordie, that if someone came to me and said, and I was like, do you read a lot? And he goes, oh, I read so much. I have read every book ever published by Bernard Cornwell. I go, oh wow, okay. Do you want to try something different? And they go, oh, what? Like, I would make the recommendation, but that person doesn't impact how much I would recommend Sharpe's Eagle. In fact, someone came to me and read, I've read every Sharpe's book apart from I've never read Sharpe's Fortress. I go, well, did you like all the Sharpe's books?
That's obviously
different. And they go, yeah. I'll go, well, then you'll probably like Sharpe's Fortress. You might want to read something else as well, but that's not going to change my recommendation of Sharpe's Fortress to the guy who's just told me he likes reading all the Bloom Sharpe's books.
I mean, obviously that's not the same, and I think you know that.
Basically, like, the same.
You're talking about completion, you're talking about finishing a series.
No.
I'm talking about
okay.
The whole subgenre of books, which are just the same.
Someone who's read all the Sharpe's books and goes, I'm thinking of reading the Saxon stories.
What if, Duncan, you're talking about... No, but you're not, you're moving the goalposts. What if, like, 200 different authors were all writing about, you know, were all writing different versions of Sharpe or different aspects of the Napoleonic War, and someone only read Napoleonic War novels?
Well, then I would recommend to them the Sharpe's books, because they'll probably like them.
Okay. We've made our positions clear. Let's wrap it up.
I mean, I've asked people to hit us on the socials, and you give them the new book. This is actually a goodbye time. So thank you, everyone, for listening to our extended rant on Bonesmith. It's been a pleasure, as always, and we can't wait to join you next time for Watership Down. If it's a fantasy or not a fantasy, actually do let us know. I want people to weigh in on this argument early. Till next time.
Till next time, I've been Geordie Bailey.
And I've been Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.